Hello and welcome to Animates. This program is recorded at 2RPH Sydney for the RPH Network. I'm Katie Brooks. Normally on this program, we look at the role animals play in our modern lives, but today we're going to take a trip back through history to learn about how the ancient Egyptians related to their dogs and other animals. Our guest today is Dr. Mary Hartley from Macquarie University, who has worked extensively on archaeological digs in Australia and Egypt. What kind of things can you tell about animals from their bones?
When the archaeological excavations go on and they produce animal bones, fragmented or whole, the major thing is what the people were eating at that time and which cuts of meat they were eating, and that becomes more evident when you get lots and lots of a certain type of bone. So once we can see what they were eating, then we can look at the bones to see roughly how old these animals were, because you can tell that from various ways, and you can see if they were eating young animals or if they were eating the older animals. Now, in Sydney, obviously, when Sydney first started out and from 1788 onwards, the main product here for a long time was sheep. They used the sheep for the wool and they used the sheep to eat. And it's interesting to look at the bones and work out roughly how old these animals were. So you saw, were they eating lambs or were they eating the animals when they were older and past their good wool production days? Does that make sense?
Yes. So you can tell that by various sort of the shape of the bone.
The epiphyseal fusion, that is when the little epiphyses fuse to the long bones, the leg bones and the shoulder humeruses and things. And this occurs at different times. And it's noted when this does occur. If I can see that there's a femur and I know that the proximal end of the femur fuses at 18 months, then I know that that sheep was younger than 18 months if the epiphyses isn't fused.
Yes, so it's kind of like, if it looks like this, it must be older or younger than a given point.
Yes, and you can also start to look for pathologies on the bones as well, so to see if there's any sort of evidence of any diseases that they might have had that. This usually only occurs in the really old bones where they've had time for things to sort of work through into the bone and show itself. You get things like osteoarthritis and things like that, which is just exactly what humans get.
They're probably not going to be eating an animal that's diseased in some way.
Probably not. And a lot of diseases that are evident in the tissue and the meat wouldn't be evident in a bone either. It doesn't work through that fast and that thoroughly into the bone.
Most of the bones you've found in the Sydney context, they've been through food. Have you found any other sort of dog and cat and that kind of bones as well?
Yes, we have. The majority is, of course, sheep, with the next one being cattle. Then you have pig. Then you have rabbit. But we have also found cat. Maybe a cat went under the house and died, and some of the bones have remained under the structures of the floors. I haven't found any dogs in Sydney yet. Lots of rodents, mice and rats, because obviously they go under the floorboards too and eat the bones and the residue of things and then die as well.
Yeah, well, I'm amazed that bits of mice still last.
It's absolutely incredible. Just the other day I found this tiny little innominate, which is part of the pelvis. It was absolutely complete and it would have been no longer than about 15 millimetres.
Wow.
It was tiny, yeah.
You'd have to be careful to not to miss something like that.
Exactly. The people who dug these bones up were really good.
The Sydney sites, you've been looking mostly at sites where there were houses and things.
Yeah, one site was Pyrmont, and the second site now that I'm working on at the moment is The Rocks. So they were both areas where there were houses and various businesses. So basically what we're looking at there is food waste, what products. Yeah. Coming from the food, whereas in Egypt we're looking at a totally different concept of animals and animals that are coming out of the excavation.
Do you find any native animals as well?
Not many, no. In the Pyrmont bones I found remains of a swan, which doesn't seem likely would have been eaten, but who knows, and very exotic ducks and things like that, which were probably eaten. In the bones I'm working on at the moment, which came from the rocks, I've found a wallaby pelvis. There are bones sometimes that I can't identify because they're so different, or, you know, I can say what the bone is. It's a femur or something, but I can't tell you what it is. And that usually occurs with birds and things, because I think with the birds, sometimes maybe a cat caught a bird or took a bone back under the house to eat. But we did find a pelican. So all sorts of things do emerge. But whether they were eaten or whether they were just dragged under there by something, I don't know.
I was just wondering whether marsupial bones look quite different to other kinds of mammals.
They're all very similar. They're all just different sizes and slightly different in shape. But yeah, you can pick up a femur and it's a femur. Whether it's a marsupial or a mammal or a duck or anything, it's very identifiable if you know what you're looking for.
It's just the biologist in me that asked that question.
Good.
As you were saying, your job, you go on to archaeological digs. Do you go and dig in the ground, or is it just when somebody finds a bone, they get you in to look at it? How does that one work?
In Australia, definitely. Someone else has dug up these bones years ago, and now I'm identifying them and studying them. But when I go to Egypt, and I work on site in Egypt, in Dendera and Luxor, the local men do all the digging, and when they find anything at all, it comes back through an area where everything gets looked at, and the animal bones get passed to me. Then I sit in the dirt and literally identify which element they are and which animal they've come from and things like that.
What prompted you to specialise in animal bones and Egypt and all that sort of thing?
Well, I started off by wanting to go on an archaeological dig.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you, exactly? It's really interesting. So I was going through university and I applied and I was accepted to go as part of the team. I went for many years. On one dig, we came across thousands and thousands of dog bones, literally skulls, postcranial bones, humeruses, everything. There was just thousands of them, and we thought, heck, what do we do with these? And I was working alongside the person who was studying the human bones, and she said to me, someone needs to look at these bones and do perhaps a PhD. So eventually I agreed to do this, and it was absolutely fascinating looking at all these dog remains or working out if they were dog or perhaps they were jackal or perhaps they were fox, because in ancient Egypt they revered Anubis, who was the canid god. Literally any form of canid would have done as an offering to be buried. I looked at these and I did my PhD and I found all animal remains so interesting that I sort of diversified when I finished and started to look at other animals and what they were doing and where they were, basically in Egypt first and then back here in Australia in the last couple of years.
Can you tell us a bit more about that pit? Did you find out any ideas about what all those bones were doing there?
They were down in a tomb. We were digging down looking for the New Kingdom area of the Teti Cemetery, and we went into one of the old tombs and all these bones were in two of the burial chambers of these tombs. So they'd been stacked in there. So being a New Kingdom tomb, that meant that they had been put there after the New Kingdom, probably. In the late period, in the Greco-Roman period, which is quite late in Egyptian history, then the votive trade took off enormously, and it became something that the common person, the ordinary person in Egypt, could participate in. They could go to the local temple, they could buy a mummified dog or any of the other animals that were mummified. They could make a votive offering of it, and then they could walk away. Now, the temples filled up pretty quickly, as you can imagine, because so many people took on this practice that they had to empty the temples about once a year, I think. The Anubiaon was right next to the cemetery we were working in. There is writing in the Roman records that tell you that once a year, with drums banging and banners waving, they removed all the animal mummies that were in the temple, and with great pomp and ceremony they went to another sacred space, and then they put all the ones that they just brought out of the temple down into a storage pit, because it was sort of thought of that the cemetery was a sacred area. So when we came along 3,000 years later and dug down, there they all were.
I've heard about that with offerings of mummified animals with cats, so they did it with dogs as well.
Oh, yes, they did it with cats, with dogs, with the ibis. They did it with crocodiles. Bulls weren't quite so common because they were really sacred and that was completely different, but they did mummify them and bury them. But the average person could use any of those in their offerings to the gods if they wanted whatever they asked for.
Do we know much about animals in the daily life of Egypt?
There's a fair amount of information about that. You've got to remember that the history of ancient Egypt is a long time.
Yes.
Right? It's thousands of years. It's not just sort of 100 years. But we have got evidence on walls. We've got wall scenes that show us what they were doing with animals and how they used them on the farms and things like that. They also show how they were used in sacred ways. So we've got a pretty good idea that they had these animals. They had cows and they had sheep and they had goats. And being a non-monetary society, wealth was based on the animals and what you owned. So if you wanted to count your wealth, you counted how many cattle you owned and how many sheep you owned and things like that.
Was there evidence for maybe using dogs in hunting and that sort of thing?
Yes, they were very much hunting. Now, this is really interesting because if you go right back before the pharaohs, so before Egypt was unified into one state, there was lots of little communities that existed along the Nile, and they were all totally independent. And the really, really early ones where we first start to get pottery that has got pictures on it that were actually placed in the graves with people, and obviously important people, there are scenes of men hunting with dogs on leashes. And in those communities, what we also have is these beautiful burial grounds, which are a part of the cemeteries, where we have found numerous animal burials. I'll just give you a quick example. It is in Hierakonpolis, which is in the southern part of Egypt, just north of Aswan. There is this wonderful cemetery full of animal burials. There are all sorts of wild animals. So obviously in that really early time, and they were starting to assert themselves as little local important communities, the hunters must have gone out past the desert and into the savannas where they could hunt animals, but not hunt to kill and bring back to eat, but to hunt and to capture, to bring back, to hold in captivity. And then they were used with the burials of these very important people when they died. So in Hierakonpolis Cemetery, HK6, you've got this important gentleman who was buried in the main tomb. Around him, in almost like a circle, you've got important human burials. And then surrounding that, you've got these burials of elephants and aurochs and baboons and dogs, all animals that would have been hunted and brought back in and kept. And we know that they were kept alive because the bones have got these paleopathologies on them that are totally consistent with an animal being tethered around the leg. Mm. And the elephant, when it was dug up, the remains of its stomach were still there. And there were things that it would never have eaten in the wild, pottery sherds and fish bones and seeds and things like that that didn't exist in the wild. So they were kept in captivity, so they were then killed and buried with that person.
So was it a form of, this is an important person because we're sending him off with all these different kinds of animals?
Yeah, to bring an elephant back in as a captured animal would be, you know, wow. They were really, really important people, and this is how they showed how important they were.
Well, it shows a certain amount of organisation in society to think you can keep an elephant.
And to understand how to keep the elephant alive.
Do you think these would have been, on some level, considered like the way we have pets in the modern world?
No, I do not. I do not think they had any concept of being a pet at all. Not for those animals that I've just spoken about. Also, not at all for these votive animals that became so prolifically used in the late period, in the Roman period.
Well, they almost sound like industrial-scale offerings.
Oh, absolutely. They were mass-bred. They were mass-killed and wrapped and sent off as votive offerings. There was absolutely nothing to do with being a pet or loved or anything like that. But that's not to say that the Egyptians didn't have pet dogs, because you have got scenes on the tomb walls from the Old Kingdom onwards where the deceased and his wife are sitting on their chairs, and under the chair there can be a dog or a cat or something like that, which shows that they had these animals with them and they were part of their lives.
Are any of those kind of animals ever seen in tombs?
Yes, there have been a few. I've got a database when I did my work, and my head goes straight to an 11th dynasty burial that was dug up at Luxor, which was the old Thebes. And there was a man, his wife, and there was about five children, I think, and just at the entrance of the tomb was a dog burial. I frequently found that when I had some sort of family or community burial, that the dog burial would be placed near the door. And many people have interpreted that as that man's pet dog, whereas I see that as that dog being placed at the door as a protective element.
It sounds like it's a guard dog or something.
Yes, and I think guard dogs were particularly important in Egypt, as were the hunting dogs. I think the hunting dogs were very important too.
Because in many ways it'd be what we'd look at now as a working dog kind of relationship.
Yes, much more so. I think the dog was always significant right the way through. I think because they were such an important part in that really early time when the hunters went out and hunted and brought back live animals, and they did it with dogs. We have pictures that have been painted on pottery that show us this. I think they were always extremely important. So as the important people rose through the hierarchy, I think the dogs sort of went with them as elements of guarding, looking after them. So when the person went to the afterlife, the dogs went with them as a protector. But basically what happened in Egypt with the dogs was that I think in the very early stages it was something to do with the jackals, the wild dogs, and then I think because more and more people started to do it as time went on until you get to the late period when everybody was able to use the dog, they had to switch to dogs which could be farmed and bred and quickly turned over rather than try and rely on sort of the wild animals.
As there was more population, they needed more of them?
Yeah, as it became something that became more and more accepted that the ordinary person could do, then we needed more and more. In the catacombs in Saqqara, there is an area there that is just pure dogs, and over 8 million dog remains have been found in that area.
Wow, that's a lot of dogs.
That's a lot of dogs. Now, I'm talking probably over a period of 600-odd years, but that's still a lot of dogs.
Even still, that's showing that people are still into sacrificing dogs. Do you know about what the ceremony to sacrifice a dog was like?
No, there's nothing written about how any of the animals were sacrificed. I can only tell you that while I was studying the cranium of the dog, many of them had a heel depressed fracture just above the eye. So during their lifetime, they must have got involved in maybe a fight or who knows. And they were whacked on the head with a stick and they gave them a fracture but didn't kill them because they carried on living and the fracture healed around the edges. So we know that they stayed alive.
Yeah, so there's no sign on the bones of what the sacrifice process might be.
No, there's no way of telling because if the dog's throats were slit, probably how it was done, there is no evidence on the bones unless they cut too hard and hit the vertebra. That's highly unlikely. People have theorised in the past strangulation, throat cut or poison. That seems to be the main three that people think that's how they've met their demise.
With the mummy process, were they packed and treated the way human mummies were?
Some of them were, yeah. So obviously there was some sort of hierarchy in this because some of them were beautifully done. Their insides would be taken out, they would be packed to make them the right shape, and then they would have been wrapped and produced into beautiful mummies with coloured cartonnage and all sorts of things. Now, they were obviously the top end, but then you get down to one little pup that I looked at in a paper that was less than 6 months old, and it had been very cursorily wrapped in some linen and popped into a grave. When they did analysis of that little pup, they found out that it was absolutely riddled with fleas and ticks, which were awful. And the only thing it had in its stomach was two date stones. So obviously it had just eaten two dates just before it died. That shows you the big difference between the ones that were really done beautifully and properly and then these cursory little ones at the end that anything just got wrapped up and sold to somebody as to go off and make it into an offering.
So were they all the full dog or were there some that were just sort of bits of dog?
There's a lot of them that are just bits of dog. Many of them are the full dog. Then you get partial dogs. So you'll get a mummy that's wrapped to look like a little animal with a little head and two ears, but inside you'll only get three or four bones, and they can be dog bones. And then you get the next step where you get a little mummy that's been wrapped with a little head and two little ears that looks like a dog mummy. And in that mummy, there'll be no dog bones at all. There'll be some pieces of wood. And then you can also get the same thing, but instead of pieces of wood, you'll just get a human bone that they've popped in there. So either the priests who were in charge of the mummifying the animals were being dishonest, or that was considered okay to do, and they did it. my thoughts go more towards the priests were probably being a little bit dishonest and had run out of dogs or run out of something, so they popped in whatever they could to make it look like a dog.
Well, you can stretch it a bit further if you don't put the whole dog in, I guess.
Yes, well, you can have three or four mummies if you don't put the whole dog in each one.
Yes, and if you put just a bit of wood in there, then, you know, you don't even need a dog.
Yes, that doesn't happen tremendously a lot, but it does happen. Definitely it happened. My head goes across to when I was in Western Australia in Perth once, and the museum there was putting what they thought was a mummified cat through a scanner to see what was actually inside. So they weren't going to unwrap the mummy, they just wanted to have a look. And inside it was just one human piece of bone. And it was definitely human because the human anthropologists were standing beside me and they recognised it. Now, I guess once you've wrapped something up, nobody can tell, can you?
Until we come along in vet x-rays, I guess.
Exactly, yes, but I think that's 3,000 years later.
Yes, a bit too late to take it up with them.
Yeah,
probably.
A bit too late, yeah, yes.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
It's a very fascinating place, it really is, and the history is absolutely fascinating, and we just learn more and more all the time, which makes things become more and more easy to understand. It's just great. It's really interesting.
And that brings us to the end of another episode of Animates. This program has been recorded in the studios of 2RPH Sydney for the RPH Network. Researched by Joseph Schwanzer, and I'm Katie Brooks. Please join us again next time for more stories of animals and their mates. ¶¶